Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And we don't start, as we usually do on Fridays, with our weekly Ask the Mayor segment. The mayor, because of schedule conflicts, was here yesterday. So those of you calling in or tuning in for Ask the Mayor, we already did it this week. Come back next Friday. He is scheduled to return to his normal schedule. Meanwhile, did this really happen? Did President Trump's director of national intelligence really just get fired because his election security director briefed Congress on Russia's plans to help Trump get reelected this year? That's what the Washington Post and New York Times are reporting. The Times quotes five people familiar with the matter saying Trump personally dressed down Director of National Intelligence Joseph McGuire last week. Then on Wednesday, boom, McGuire was replaced by a Mar-a-Lago member with no intelligence experience. Maybe Trump was still angry at McGuire for his testimony in September about the Trump-Ukraine whistleblower or how McGuire described himself.
I am not partisan, and I am not political. I believe in a life of service, and I am honored to be a public servant. I believe the whistleblower is operating in good faith.
Well, then they couldn't
followed the law.
They couldn't be in good faith if they were acting as a political hack, could they?
Mr. Chairman, my job is to support and lead the entire intelligence community. That individual works for me. Therefore, it is my job to make sure that I support and defend that person.
You don't have any reason to accuse them of disloyalty to our country or suggest they're beholden to some other country, do you?
Sir, absolutely not.
Joseph McGuire with Adam Schiff, the House Intelligence Committee chairman, whose voice you might have recognized last September. Last week's briefing was also to the Intelligence Committee, and the president is reportedly upset that Schiff was among those being briefed on anything having to do with Russia wanting to help Trump again, because Trump thinks Schiff will weaponize it against him. To be clear and to be fair, it has not been reported how strong or specific the evidence was about Russia's plans to help Trump again. And Republicans on the committee reportedly argued that Russia would rather have Bernie Sanders than Trump. But what we do know is that after the briefing, Trump's director of national intelligence, Joseph McGuire, was replaced. The question for our democracy becomes, is the president turning the intelligence agencies, whose job is to provide nonpartisan information about foreign countries, into another part of the Trump political operation, like he and William Barr are allegedly doing with the Justice Department? Connecticut Congressman Jim Himes, a Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, says there's only one way to find out.
If it is true that McGuire was dressed down by the president because his people made a presentation to the Intelligence Committee, McGuire needs to speak up right now and tell the world that that is what happened. Now, I suspect McGuire wasn't alone in the room when that happened. So, again, if it happened, the people who were there, you know, can't hold their tongues, because the compromise of the intelligence community to be compromised in the service of the political aims of President Trump, I mean, that isn't even democracy. We're talking about Noriega's Panama. We are talking about, you know, Putin's Russia. We are talking about something that dictatorial regimes do. So, again, if the story is true, it is time for Mr. McGuire to come forward and say, here is what happened.
Congressman Jim Himes, Democrat from Connecticut, on MSNBC last night. Now, all of that happened on a day when Roger Stone was sentenced to less than 4 years in prison. That's within the lower range that Barr had requested in his revised sentencing request. Notably, the prosecutor representing Barr reinforced to the court that they believe the prosecution of Stone was the right thing to do. Attorney General Barr and President Trump are publicly at odds over that. And all these things happened on the day after Wednesday night's contentious Democratic debate, right? So here's a bracing fact for blue America. A new Quinnipiac poll finds any of the Democratic candidates would lose to President Trump in Wisconsin. And they really need Wisconsin if they want to flip the White House. The margins range from Trump winning by 7 points over Biden or Sanders to Trump winning by 11 points over Klobuchar. The differences between those candidates are small, really. The difference between 7 and 11, it's not that much. It's even within the range of the margin of error. The point is that Trump beats them all in this poll. They would all win in Pennsylvania and Michigan, the other two states that basically gave Trump the Electoral College in 2016, but not by much. Again, the difference between any of the candidates as they match up with Trump is negligible, but the races against Trump are close in Michigan and Pennsylvania. With me now, NPR senior political correspondent and editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico. Thanks for some time today. I can tell by listening to the network that you're going nonstop this week, so we really appreciate it.
Hello. Good to be with you.
So you're a political analyst, not a justice or intelligence reporter. Our listeners should understand that. So what can you tell from this emerging Russia story so far about the implications for free and fair elections this year?
Well, you know, I'm not saying anything anybody doesn't know, but all the politics with Trump is personal. You know, he thinks, he even tweeted, he mentioned yesterday at an event that he didn't think Parasite should win the Oscars because of Korean trade policy. So for him, that's the way his brain works. That's what he thinks about as far as all of this goes. And anything that's related to Russia, he immediately, sort of the hair on the back of his neck stands up and just believes that, you know, it's quote unquote a hoax, or it's intended to get him, or it's intended to somehow hurt his reelection chances. And he is focused like a laser on his reelection chances. You know, we're watching very closely what it means for election security throughout the country. You know, elections in this country are decentralized. The states run them locally. So, you know, and from everything we know with the secretaries of state that we're in touch with, they're all doing what they can to try to make sure that the the elections are safe, that the ballots can't be hacked. There are various new voting systems that are in place that we're spotlighting to see if they are, you know, can be tested, and if they're going to be operational, if there are paper ballot backups. And that's why we have an election security unit that covers a lot of that. You know, so, but the fact is, Russia is still trying to interfere in the election, and apparently, again, wanting President Trump to win. So, you know, I think the biggest test is not about hacking. Sure, they'll try that, but the disinformation campaigns that come out of Russia, they have a free filter. There's no filter to be able to go and do that. They can put out things on social media, play to people's preconceived notions about something that they like or don't like, and all the chaos that happens between candidates is just something that Russia just loves.
By the way, since you brought up that Oscars thing, would it be pushing you beyond the limits of evidence-based political analysis to wonder or speculate if, while Trump took this shot at Parasite winning Best Picture because he said we already have too much of a trade imbalance with South Korea, that the subtext there was we shouldn't be letting foreigners win our best Oscar, our best picture Oscar for movies in foreign languages, playing to one of his, you know, essential election themes?
Well, he certainly, you know, it's not really conjecture, because he said himself that why aren't we giving it to an American movie?
He did.
And he mentioned his movie was 1939's Gone with the Wind. I mean, you know, you can't win an Oscar for something that's not in that year. So this is not like a top 100 list. Like, this is the Oscar for 1 year.
A little racial subtext there, maybe, too?
You know, I think that some people probably would think that's the case as well.
Back to intelligence. The Mueller report did say, that Russia was supporting Bernie Sanders in 2016 as well as Donald Trump. But it seems to me that that was in the context of defeating Hillary Clinton in the primaries and then in the general, because Sanders and Trump were both running against Clinton, and it was Clinton who Putin considered his nemesis. In the context...
Yeah,
go ahead, you go.
Yeah, and I don't think it's because Russia favors in particular one candidate or another. What they favor is chaos. They favor dissension within the American political system. You know, Secretary Clinton certainly was seen as a far and away front runner at the beginning of that race. And what better to knock her down a couple pegs than to support the person challenging her and, you know, create conspiracy theories that weren't true, but certainly played to the preconceived ideas that there was some kind of cover-up going on or the rigging of the system. That was something that fervent Sanders supporters firmly believed and were willing to believe that there was more to it. And, you know, whether there was any evidence of some of that, you know, Russia certainly was happy to play to that. And that's what they do when it comes to race in America. That's what they've done when it comes to any of the candidates who are opposing President Trump, because, you know, they're perfectly happy having him in office if he's going to take Putin's side on various things. And he certainly has. I mean, we saw that in Helsinki, where he doubted that there was any interference that Russia was going along with. He's certainly pulling out of Syria, where the U.S. Abandoned the Syrian Kurds. That's something that certainly helps Russia from their want to kind of have a hold in that region.
And there's certainly no reason to think that Sanders would pull a Helsinki, would be someone who fawns over Putin at an international event while sneering at the leaders of Western Europe and pretending nothing is happening when Putin is trying to poison Western democracy. Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's certainly, you know, Senator Sanders has certainly spoken out against Russian interference. And of course, he likes Western Europe. He loves Northern Europe. He likes the democratic socialist approaches of healthcare as a universal right in those countries. You know, free college tuition, for example. So, you know, he's looking to restructure the United States in a way that looks more like that. So he certainly would say good things about them.
Yeah. And why are we talking about this, listeners? Because this may be the defense from Republican members of Congress if this Russia interfering again on behalf of Trump story continues to develop. The Mueller report did say that Russia was supporting Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump in 2016. So it's important to deconstruct the details of what that might mean or doesn't mean. You heard the clip of Congressman Heim saying the fired director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, should go public and say whether he thinks Trump is letting him go to politicize the intelligence agencies. Is there any early indication that McGuire might go public?
You know, it's not clear at this point. I mean, you know, if he winds up leaving, obviously, government service and he's subpoenaed to do so, he would be required to do so. So he may, you know, testify in that way. I don't know what his behind the scenes kind of thinking is going to be about this instance. You know, there are some people who've obviously come forward. You know, I think about the former Navy Secretary, Richard Spencer, who came out and talked about some of what his discussions were with President Trump. But most people who've left the administration try not to talk about it, but, you know, you never know. We would certainly keep tabs on any speeches that he made. I mean, think about someone like John Kelly, the former White House Chief of Staff, you know, initially didn't say a whole heck of a lot, but you can read between the lines of some of what he was thinking about the Ukraine affair and how he didn't think it was appropriate and that there hasn't been a check on President Trump since.
And this comes just as William Barr reportedly said last week that he might resign if Trump keeps publicly pressuring or contradicting the work of the Justice Department. And Trump did it again yesterday, saying, I guess in the same speech where he said the Oscar went to the wrong country, that Roger Stone has a good chance of being exonerated, while Barr's own prosecutor in court told the judge that the prosecution was righteous, something Barr himself also said to ABC last week. We played that clip yesterday. So do you have any indication that Barr, I mean, this would be a moment, right? If Barr and McGuire came out publicly saying Trump is trying to politicize the intelligence agencies and the Justice Department, it may well be a moment that never happens, but these things are happening at the same time.
I doubt you're going to see Bill Barr do that. He's somebody who is dealing with sort of a two-front battle. He's got a very, you know, low morale issue to deal with at the Justice Department. You know, when you undermine prosecutors who've been working on a case for a while, there are a whole lot of other prosecutors and former prosecutors who don't think that that's appropriate. So he needed to show that he could do something to sort of keep them on board. And there's no easier thing for a conservative to criticize President Trump on than his tweeting. You know, that's something we hear all the time when we go out on the campaign trail. It's not enough for them not to vote for him, but it's certainly something that they say that they wish he would do less of. So that's, you know, he's got a degree of political cover on that. He has senators in Congress who have backed him and said that the president should listen to him. And they prefer Barr's approach because it's not far-flung. It's not ad hoc. It's pretty calculated. So what he's doing and what he does tends to have some strategy behind it. And the senators, like Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate Majority Leader, certainly likes that kind of approach more so than the kind of chaotic approach of President Trump.
Domenico Montanaro is with us, NPR senior political correspondent and editor. We can take some phone calls at 212-433-WNYC as we segue to the presidential race. So on any of these things, 212-433-9692. To make a segue to the presidential race, all this stuff the last few months about Trump, Ukraine, and impeachment, and politicizing foreign policy, and the Justice Department, and pardons, and now intelligence, doesn't seem to be dragging him down in public opinion polls, does it?
Not at all. In fact, in our polling, the NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll, the latest one just last week showed him, or this past week showed him at 44% with registered voters. That's a pretty good number from our poll, considering where he's been. It's been fairly consistent overall. He's been around 41-42% overall. And the thing that's really buoying him is the strong economy. I mean, when you're at 3.5% unemployment, sure, the economy is not working for everybody, and Democrats will certainly make that point. And Republicans tried to make that point against President Obama in 2012. And it's an uphill battle. That's a difficult thing for Democrats to argue. I think the real issue with President Trump is that he's not doing better than that, considering his approval rating on the economy is around 50-54%. And that really speaks to his character and some sort of the problems that people have with what they see as his public demeanor, what he means for the country, his ethic standards, what he did with Ukraine. I think all of those things combined, you know, it rubs a lot of or a majority of the country in the wrong way. But his economic approval, there may be a degree of people in that sort of persuadable range who say, you know, why change what is going well? And that's what's helping booing him right now.
Let's take a phone call. This is pushback against the idea that Trump supports Russia. Maurice in Shrewsbury, New Jersey. Hi, Maurice. You're on. Yes. Thanks so much for calling.
Yes, yes. Regarding the narrative that Putin and Trump are in cozy with each other, according to last night, Fox News was pointing out to counter that President Trump, if he had such a cozy relationship, why did he put all these different tons of sanctions on Putin? So they use that to counter it. And, you know, when you shuttle back between CNN and Fox, you get a totally different slant on things.
That's
and you
true.
Try to figure out where the truth is. So I wanted to put that out there.
That's true. And it is a mixed bag. If you look at the whole Trump administration record, there are the sanctions. There's the fact that Trump approved those Javelin missiles going to Ukraine in the first place, which the Obama administration had opposed because they made a judgment that it was going to risk escalating more than it was going to risk protecting Ukraine. And it is a mixed bag. But at the same time, there is this repeated pattern of Trump elevating Putin to a stature in the world that Putin aspired to before the Trump administration came in. And so you put the pieces together, and I think the evidence, you know, falls on that side. But Maurice, you can say one other thing if you want, and I appreciate you pointing out the differences between the analyses.
Yes, and also just Fox News pointed out yesterday that regarding the other issue of you were talking about before, Trump firing, dressing down, whatever his name was, because of what he exposed about what Russia's doing. They had, of course, a different slant on that, but they also brought in not just their own opinion. They brought in Devin, I think it's Nunez, I think his name was.
The Republican, leading Republican on the Intelligence Committee, right?
Yeah, I mean, they brought in politicians that, you know, the government saying that this is just not true.
Maurice, thank you, and keep calling us. We appreciate it. Anything you want to add to that, Domenico, before we move on?
Yeah, I mean, look, it is definitely a mixed bag when it comes to Russia. I mean, the president, though, we have to realize it's not like he's Dmitry Medvedev, who's, you know, essentially working for Vladimir Putin in Russia. You know, he is the American president, but he's for Donald Trump first. So whatever he sees that can help him is what he's going to do. Whatever that means to help him win re-election, to win political power, that's the thing that he most sees as primary in his brain. It's not to, you know, maintain whatever, you know, American security stance that there's been since World War II. He disagrees with a lot of that. So if there's some way that it can help him, make him look good, then he's okay with it. I mean, think about Ukraine and what he did with Ukraine. I mean, this wasn't a campaign to help Russia. It had the effect of helping sort of further Russian disinformation, but maybe unwittingly from President Trump. What he's trying to do is figure out a way to help him win re-election in 2020. And part of that was seeing that Ukraine creates investigations into conspiracy theories related to the DNC hacking in 2016, and as it relates to former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden. That's what it's all about, and I think people need to orient how they think about the president in that way.
Can you tell us more about this Wisconsin finding from the Quinnipiac poll? I see you tweeted that out today.
Yeah, really eye-opening. Wisconsin might be the most important state in the 2020 election. It leans slightly more conservative than Michigan and Pennsylvania, and I think that's borne out by the results that you were mentioning about the Democrats leading in Pennsylvania and Michigan. And, you know, if Democrats can't win Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania and lose all the same states that they lost last time, they can't win. You know, there's a very plausible, scary scenario where they could lose Wisconsin and you wind up with a tie. That would be a lot of fun. Not for anyone, but that would, by the way, then go to the House based on the 12th Amendment. The House, each state would have their own vote. You'd have to have a majority of each state, and the Senate would vote for a vice president. That vice president would wind up serving as the president until the House could come up with who the president would be. It would just be a total mess.
Can I linger on that for just a second? And we'll do a separate segment on this, folks, at some point. The nightmare scenario of a tie in the Electoral College, in which case the presidential election gets thrown into the House of Representatives. If people are thinking, well, the Democrats have the majority in the House of Representatives, so that would settle that. You started to explain why it's not that, that ultimately each state gets one vote based on the majority of their House delegation. Is that it?
Yeah, based on the majority of their House delegation, how that House delegation would want to vote. And remember, because these districts have been so gerrymandered to be more right-leaning, you could have a situation where it's not real clear, which direction it would go. You'd have a whole lot of game theory going on with a lot of people who really understand this stuff and trying to survey what members of Congress, members of the House would do.
Right.
I mean, this is very far away.
If it comes down to one state, one vote, the Democrats may have the majority in the House, but it's because they have such a huge majority in huge states like California and New York. If it came down to one state, one vote, it would look a lot more like the Senate, and then it may well go to the Republican.
Yeah, it's far away. The likelihood of that is still very remote. It's plausible, but not probable, I would say, at this point. And, you know, there's also still the possibility that a state like Arizona becomes more Democratic, a state like Florida. I mean, obviously, it's been a very close state in a lot of elections. The Trump campaign is going after places like Colorado and Nevada, New Hampshire, where they were close. I mean, New Hampshire was the closest state of the 2016 election by raw vote. Only 2,700 votes separated Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Nevada is certainly trending blue. We're talking about the primary, obviously, coming up on Saturday, tomorrow. But in the general election, it was only 2.5 points or so that separated Hillary Clinton and President Trump. Obviously, if it's going in the direction where President Trump winds up winning Nevada in the general election, there's probably a whole lot of other states that Trump is doing quite well in, and we wouldn't even be close to a tie.
Ohio used to be the ultimate Midwest swing state. Now it's considered a red state, not really in play this year. If the same is starting to happen in Wisconsin, or if Wisconsin is still a swing state but a harder lift for Democrats than Pennsylvania or Michigan, is it clear why that might be?
There are more Republicans in Wisconsin than there are in Michigan and Pennsylvania. Michigan and Pennsylvania also have a little bit more of a history of voting Democratic. Wisconsin has been very close for a long time. Yes, it's gone Democratic in most of those elections, but I think the 2004 election, it was the closest election of all of them. You know, you've got Milwaukee, and basically that's it as far as Democratic areas of the state. Otherwise, it's a pretty rural Republican state. And culturally, certainly been a big shift. And by the way, one of the most highly populated states of white working class voters. And we've seen this shift away from the Democratic Party of white working class voters across the country. We're right now sitting in a situation where we're having a crack up and a reshaping of American politics. The parties, the people underneath those parties who are filling in those parties are very, very different than we saw when Bill Clinton was elected, for example, in 1992. The Democratic Party becoming certainly more populated with highly educated voters and more minorities than we've seen previously. It's grown far more liberal than it has been in the last 25 years.
Let's go on to another aspect of this, the aspect that has a lot of Democrats somewhere between scratching their heads and tearing their hair out. It's that in all these polls, NPR and Quinnipiac and ABC and NBC, the Democrats compared to each other are approximately the same in matchups against Trump. You would think from the way they were accusing each other of things in Wednesday night's debate that they were in culture wars of their own. But if the central issue for Democrats this year is electability, none of the polls coming out recently seem to give primary and caucus voters much guidance. Or do you see it differently as you read these things more closely than I do?
No, I think that's exactly right. But I think that what we really have to do, you know, look, it's important for me to be a check on myself a lot of times because I cover this stuff very closely and I, you know, follow most of the, you know, turns and twists in all of this. Most people don't do that. You know, most people just consider the choice and they look at somebody, they might like them, they might not. Are they a Democrat? Are they a Republican? They kind of lean in this direction. So they kind of go with somebody who they like, you know, the whole beer test, you know, who do you want to have a beer with is, you know, maybe too glib, but that's part of how most people vote in this country. There are certainly hyper engaged people who listen to NPR and listen to WNYC who would, you know, roll their eyes at that and be upset that that's the way it is. But that is the way it is. And I think that what we have to realize is if we step back from that, you realize that these elections, whoever comes out of this is going to get a degree of scrutiny that they haven't seen yet. And that could move numbers tremendously. Head-to-head matchups are really a tenuous thing to look at, especially during a primary campaign, because there have been plenty of presidents up for re-election who've been down in head-to-head matchups against a challenger and then went on to win by a landslide. So those can be really, really tricky to suss out electability. I keep having friends asking me, you know, who should I vote for? The liberal-leaning friends, who should I vote for? Who's got the best chance of beating Trump? I said, you know, anyone who tells you they actually know that is absolutely wrong. I don't know. And I do think that all of these candidates have major flaws. And, you know, people have to vote who they really like and see how the chips fall out.
My favorite year for who would you rather have a beer with was 2000, when people said they'd rather have a beer with George W. Bush, but he was a recovering alcoholic. So that was a little weird. Footnote to history.
And President Trump also doesn't drink. So, you know, there's that.
So the NPR poll that came out on Tuesday had the headline on your website, "Sanders rises, but socialism isn't popular with most Americans." What did you find about socialism as seen by different demographics?
That was the second day story.
Oh, sorry.
The first day story, just to give Senator Sanders his due, the first day was that Sanders has a double-digit lead and that Bloomberg had qualified for the debate. So, you know, I do want to point out the sort of juxtaposition in the fact that Sanders now has a double-digit lead in the Democratic primary, and yet we also found when we tested favorability ratings of socialism versus capitalism that socialism was widely, widely unpopular. Now, Sanders' campaign and Sanders' supporters would argue socialism's not the same as democratic socialism. And I explained what Senator Sanders is in favor of before and the sort of Northern European style economic policy system. But the fact is, most Americans don't know the difference between democratic socialism and socialism, and the Republicans are salivating at the opportunity to tag Senator Sanders and especially those frontline district members, the Democrats who are in those red-leaning districts that won in the suburbs in particular in 2018, where they see that socialism is highly unpopular. Now, look, whether that bet will pay off in the long run, I'm not sure. I mean, we are in a really strange political time where we're seeing something sort of similar to what's happened in Europe, where right-wing nativist populist rises, and then there's a backlash where you have a left-wing populism that spurs and gains momentum. You know, I don't know if there's going to be enough people in the middle who are even persuadable. Now, in those districts, those center-right districts, I can tell you that those 40 or so members who are sitting there are really, really nervous about having Senator Sanders on the ticket because they don't feel like they can defend his policies.
You also found in your poll a very clear age curve when it comes to people's perceptions of socialism. It's much more popular among younger Americans than older Americans. And I was thinking about that. And not only did young people today grow up after the Cold War, when socialism was equated with Soviet totalitarianism and the threat of nuclear annihilation, right? Not only does that feel like ancient history, young Americans have grown up in an environment of massive failures of capitalism.
For sure. And, I mean, if you're under 30 years old, I mean, if you're 29 and it's 2020, you know, you grew up right, you were born in the year when the Iron Curtain fell in 1991. So you don't even know, this is not even a thought really for what communism and socialism meant, you know, doing drills where people were hiding under their desks for nuclear fallout is not ingrained in their feelings. In fact, so you go 1991, 2001, they're 10 years old, you know, in fourth grade sitting in a classroom when 9/11 happens. So that's what they've grown up with, and that's what they've seen. They've seen massive failures of the economic system, massive failures of a government that's gone to war in two major Middle Eastern and Asian countries. You know, that is a very different generation for what they've seen, and they've also, by the way, seen how humongous student debt is and how astronomically tuition has gone up. It's really, a remarkable thing, you know, that you have essentially an entire generation of people who are going to be stuck paying off student loans till they're in their 50s, when that's not the way it used to be 40 years ago, 50 years ago, even less than that. So this is a generation that's seen massive failures. They blame both parties for a lot of those economic difficulties. You know, I think that they're more open to socialism. But even millennials and Gen Z, it was only like 38% that had a favorable view of it.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah. Although if that's a lot higher than their parents, they're also, beyond the student debt, the first generation not to expect to do better than their parents economically en masse, even as the number and power of billionaires and big corporations over our political leaders has increased, and that makes Bernie Sanders' popularity among 18 to 35-year-olds pretty logical based on their material experiences, not just some kind of wacky idealism of the young. So just looks to me like that as a matter of political analysis.
I agree completely, and I think that the further along that this sort of chaos develops within the Democratic primary competition, Sanders gains in strength as far as being potentially able to win the nomination. That is, unless someone like Elizabeth Warren, after her fiery debate the other night, is able to sort of regain traction and start pulling from Sanders again. Otherwise, you know, Sanders is very likely bet to gain the most delegates going into the convention. Not a majority of delegates. I think it's very difficult for almost anybody to gain a majority of delegates, 50% plus one, the 1,991 that they need, because of how splintered the field is. And boy, can you imagine what a disaster it would be for the Democratic Party? You have someone like Bernie Sanders goes into the convention with maybe 30% of the delegates, somebody else at maybe 20, the rest in the teens, and the party gives it to somebody else other than Sanders, you know, because he couldn't get a coalition to 50%. That would be quite the divide.
Let me touch two other things before you go. One, to follow up on the economic pessimism of young Americans that we were just talking about. At the same time, the NPR poll found that optimism about the country is at an 8-year high. And I don't know if you saw the Gallup poll the other day that found economic optimism is higher than at any time since they started asking that question in 1977. So given the mass inequality and affordability crises that still reign for the rising generations, I wonder if the optimism isn't just compared to lower expectations than baby boomers or Gen Xers had as kids. Is there any way to measure that?
Well, we've had 12 straight months of under 4% unemployment. So, you know, I mean, when you've got 41% of people saying that they think the country's headed in the right direction, you know, a majority still don't think so, but it's pretty easy to see why people are feeling a little bit more confident that this recovery is stabilized. And, you know, again, that's absolutely true that the country is not working for everybody economically. But when people see and have it, when people have a job, when their income is consistent, when they're not getting evicted from their homes, we're not stuck in a 2008 situation anymore, that people really feel like this recovery is real. Now, we'll see what happens in the next several months, but that's why you see people feeling a little bit more optimistic about the state of the U.S. economy.
Last thing. Any way to tell yet who rose or fell, if anyone, from Wednesday night's debate? I know what the pundit narratives have tended to be, and I'm not going to repeat them because they're so often wrong. But any data yet on that?
No data I've seen or that I would pay attention to, frankly, from post-debate. You know, those one-day turnaround polls are usually not the best, you know. And I mean, the narrative is what the narrative is, that, you know, Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, struggled in the debate. I do think there's probably still a sizable chunk of the party that's very open to Bloomberg because of the amount of money he spent on ads to define himself and the fact that they want a candidate who's going to spend as much as possible to beat President Trump. If the goal is to beat President Trump, then having somebody who's willing to spend, you know, more or what the president is actually worth, which is what he said he would do, you know, anywhere from $1 billion to up to $5 billion to try to get Trump out. That's appealing and attractive to a lot of moderate Democrats. I don't think he helped himself with that debate because he winds up now, I think, being the most polarizing figure in the party. He certainly alienated a lot of progressives with his comments on women and non-disclosure agreements at his company. And, you know, I think that that helps someone like Sanders, again, because of all the chaos and the splintering. I do wonder if it's going to give someone like Joe Biden a second look. You know, if he does well in Nevada and wins in South Carolina, that could push Bloomberg a little bit to the side. But unquestionably, Bloomberg is going to take votes from Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar and reduce whatever their potential margin would have been and probably have Sanders, you know, if not in the lead, fairly competitive as the mm-hmm. top vote getter.
One data point that I did see, and tell me if you can confirm this, indicates that however people reacted to that debate, it may be the most consequential Democratic primary debate or political debate outside a general presidential election in a long, long time because so many people saw it. And I guess one of the reasons is it was on regular NBC, not just cable. And with the narrative buildup to Bernie versus Bloomberg and, you know, the other candidates also having a lot of star power at this point, that about 20 million people watch that debate. And if that's true, I think that would make it the third most watched television show of the year, behind only the Super Bowl and the Oscars.
Yeah, I saw both of those. So I guess then a lot of people probably saw the debate too. You know, we'll see. I mean, when things are hyped as the most, you know, anything of anything, I guess as a New Yorker, I'm always skeptical. But, you know, I think that this debate certainly put Bloomberg front and center. A lot of people probably tuned in to see what he would be like. He did not show up as, you know, the person who's going to clear the field, which is maybe what he wanted to do. He'll have another chance at that on Tuesday in South Carolina at that debate. You know, it'll be curious. You know, right now Bernie Sanders is the front runner in Nevada. Does anybody else sort of rise? And we can draw parallels maybe to what they did in this debate. If not, and it just sort of shakes out the way it already looks, then maybe the debate wasn't so consequential.
Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent, thanks for giving us so much time. We'll be listening for you on the network.
Hey, you're welcome. It was fun.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.